So Texas just had the worst weekend of sports this year so far. There's still time. There's still time. But so far, it's had the worst weekend of sports. But we're going to focus on basketball and hope that y'all pretend we are football. I'm your host, Will Bazer, and I'm joined by Johnny Brashear and Tim Preston. We're going to go over losing to Radford, what happened there, why did it happen, and how damning is this loss for Shaka Smart. Then go over the next two games, which are two big games against VCU, Shaka's old team, and Purdue, who is not a bad team. So let's go ahead and break the episode open. And to do that, we're going to do it with Pretend You're Getting to Know Us. This one is a little bit special. It's one that is inspired because I found out that grating onions is a very dangerous sport. I didn't really understand how the combination of a grater and an onion would cause one to basically slice the tip of their finger off. But when you grate onions, it's worse than dicing them because the juices get everywhere and you start crying. You can't see what you're doing. And you end up with a huge freaking... Y'all want to describe what this looks like?
It looks like you have a ping pong ball wrapped in duct tape around your finger.
Yeah, I would agree.
Or maybe like a computer mouse that you've duct taped for efficiency.
Or like
the end of your finger.
Maybe the world's shittiest ice cream cone.
These are all good pictures of what my finger looks like right now. So this week's Pretend You're Going to Know Us will be...
A tiny boxing glove that you're going to play with your nephew with.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's a good one, too. Yeah, it does look like a boxing glove. But this week's Pretend You're Going to Know Us will be what's
like
the worst injury...
like when you can't find your girlfriend's clitoris.
God damn it.
And you just... You go, I'm gonna go for max surface area. Like, I don't really... This is going to turn into horseshoes and hand grenades. Oh, like, I don't need to be that accurate. I'm just...
I don't even know if we can keep that in the show, but it's happening because I can't edit for anything this week. But what is the worst injury y'all have ever had? Johnny, we'll start off with you.
Okay, so I was
we're going back to that cat in the driveway.
Yeah, well, no, not quite. All of my injuries have been remarkably pedestrian, you know, sprained ankles or bruised this or that, you know, like I don't think I've actually broken a bone at any point. So what I decided to recount
is, white collar sports.
yeah the sport that Tim coaches is the one I played. So I decided to think of the worst time I hurt someone else, and in high school, one of the jobs I had was putting up signs for my dad's real estate business. And these are not, you know, little yard signs. These are like 4 foot by 8 foot, you know, giant, like large signs that are made of not cardboard, but like, you know, plywood. And you had to dig post holes and put the posts in and set the concrete, et cetera, all that kind of stuff. And I had a buddy who was a year ahead of me in high school who had a 78 Bronco that was burnt orange, even though he went to A&M. And he would help me sometimes because he, you know, he needed cash too. So the problem came in that we would have to pull the posts out from old signs from time to time, just to get them out of the way so we could put up the signs we needed to put up. So we would have to invent ways to get those posts out of the ground. We didn't have the most professional tools on account of being 16, 17 years old. And at one point, we used his Bronco to loosen up one of those posts by just ramming it in this small, like it was, you know, those sort of moments. And so we had one where we had actually gotten it down.
Don't fuck up my shit, Johnny.
No, look, I let him do that. It was his Bronco. So, you know, and he was happy to do it. It was fun. So one of them, we managed to get down to where it was about 3 feet tall. Like, it had splintered apart, and it was 3 feet tall, and we were trying to figure out ways to get something that short actually, out of its post. So we were using what was available in the back of the Bronco, which included a pickaxe.
This is going terribly.
Yes. We were out there for
a while. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, we were out there for a while. We were getting desperate for ideas. And so at one point, he's... we're taking turns, taking swings, just trying to do whatever we can do. And he's like, we're on opposite sides of this post. And it's my turn to take a swing because he's been going at it for a while. And he decides to, like, he stands sort of like 3 feet to my right, 2 to 3 feet to my right. And I take a swing and I take it like parallel to the ground, and it goes exactly over the post and pops him right in the balls. Now, thankfully, he had good enough reflexes that he was able to, like, sort of jump and glance the blow. Like, it actually kind of...
It's a pickaxe?
Yes. It kind of hit him in the hand with, honestly, it probably should have hit him in the stomach, but he jumped and caught and like hit it with his hand. And I was also, 140 pounds and weak as shit. So I really didn't have that much force behind it, probably, even though I was trying. And I remember him he turned out to be okay in the long term. We didn't go to the hospital. It wasn't as bad as initially feared. But he was on the ground laughing hysterically because he was trying not to murder me. And that was actually his direct quote was, some sort of, ha 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 ha, I'm trying not to kill you, kind of thing. I had to laugh too. I didn't know what else to do. He was okay enough. He was laughing. And I sat there laughing too, and then it got really uncomfortable because I didn't know how else to react, and there was no blood or anything. So he eventually got up after a while, and I'm still here, so he did not murder me, which I'm thankful for.
I wish this was a video podcast because the look on Tim and I's faces is just one of
you took a full cut with a pickaxe. You hit another dude in the balls.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much the size of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know how mine... Lord. I don't know, Tim, you said yours was good, but I'll go first.
I thought it was fine. Sheesh.
Yeah, I'll go next because, I mean, mine's pretty short.
Did I just Christmas cat this thing?
Yeah, kinda. Okay. Kinda Christmas catted this one.
All right.
But, because... I mean, I've just had a lot of injuries. Like, I've been in the emergency room almost every year except for my first, second, and third grade years of my life. Not all of them are, like, injuries. Most of them are just, like, I was born with a illness that one in every 1,000 male Caucasian babies have within the first 3 weeks of their life. But...
I always knew you were special.
Yeah, special in a way. It's... I have to say, I guess my worst injury is one that's kind of on me because it was actually my last one. I tore my labrum because I went to a lacrosse game, tore it doing a face-off, came off the field, was like, it doesn't hurt that bad, went back in and tore it again. So doing the exact same thing one play later. That's basically it. I've broken...
What is the labrum? I forget.
Like your rotator cuff?
It's kind of like the rotator cuff,
okay,
but not so much. It's in your shoulder. It kind of makes it so that you can move your shoulder. Yeah. I'm not a doctor, but I've broken both feet, broken both hands. I've broken my back. I've destroyed the tendons in my right ankle. I've had a lot of concussions, which just can probably... explain quite a bit.
That's why you're here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but it has to be the worst one. And Johnny, I'm just not even going to try to beat whatever the hell you just did. Tim?
Yeah, me neither.
Sorry, guys. I didn't mean to Christmas cactus, but I guess it happened.
Yeah, that's all right.
No,
man.
You only just try to take somebody's balls off with a pickaxe.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't try. It was like, if I had tried, I would have missed. I'm going to be honest.
That's
like,
how bad you are at tennis.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess, oh man, sheesh, pickaxe balls. So the summer after my freshman year of college, I was back at home, and one of my good friend's dads had his own construction company. So all of our friend group, we worked for his construction company, and they were building a brand new, again, it's a very small town in Iowa, but they were building a brand new kind of a condo slash apartment complex for like older
four people.
Well, at least older people. Probably, I mean, I don't want to say like geriatric, like whatever, but you know, like 55 plus, whatever. So why not?
Really, really, really old people.
Yeah,
wow.
Just incredibly old. You know, John, like 2 or 3 months away from
like
where
Johnny
Johnny's gonna be
age.
At.
Wow.
Yeah. And and
look,
so why
guys,
not hire
you
a bunch
guys better
of
be careful. I have access to a Home Depot. Like, and I know where you guys live.
Pickaxe.
I can rent
everywhere.
A pickaxe in a minute. So, anyways, so we didn't know what we were doing. Like, literally, I had never worked construction before, so that was a formative time for me because whatever I know about like home improvement stuff, I learned that summer. But so we had laid the entire the basement was the parking garage, and so we had laid the whole concrete for that, and that sucked. That was terrible. But one of the things we did one day is we had laid a spot that apparently we were not supposed to lay concrete over. And like, we're talking like 2.5 or 3 feet or whatever, like thick of concrete. Well, our jackhammers were in Des Moines, about 45 minutes away. And the people were coming within hours to pour the concrete for the elevator shafts, which are supposed to go down quite a ways into the earth. Like, I don't remember what it was for sure, but I remember it was something like however high up it goes, how many stories up it goes, that's how deep it had to go. So, but we have a large block of concrete over this. And so we're like, well, we should probably do something about that. So we get these sledgehammers out. And like, here's like all these, you know, 19 and 20 year olds just pounding sledgehammers onto this totally...
pickaxes.
Yeah, onto these totally dry, totally, you know, like, well, not totally dry, but, you know, very, very dry concrete. And it's going as slowly as you could possibly imagine. So we're waiting for the jackhammers to come.
It's going
and
Shawshank Redemption slow.
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, it's like, I was not a great athlete, but I was like, oh, I'll get this going. I'll get this going. And then nothing, just like barely skimming the surface. So, but we got like, we're going for like 45 minutes. And I'm just drenched in sweat. And one of my other friends stops. Well, he was using one of those sledgehammers that was like chisel edged. So I was like, oh, nice. So I took that sledgehammer and put it into one of the crevices that we had created. And I started hitting that sledgehammer with my sledgehammer.
No.
And it was going beautifully. And like I probably made it farther in 10 or 15 swings than I had the entire rest of the time, until I took one cut, and all of a sudden, my right arm just shoots back, and a piece of sledgehammer about the size of a 9mm bullet shoots into my arm and goes right into my bicep and like kind of touches the edge of my tricep. And like, I am just
like... This might
have
not been the best idea for a question I've had. This is making me cringe.
Sorry, man. Everything like ends up being fine. Like I had pain for like a year and a half, but it ended up being okay. But like, you know, I'm a tennis player. It goes like I'm at UNI, and I'm like, all right, well, here we are. Like, oh my gosh, am I gonna lose money or whatever? And it's like we go to the hospital, and like blood is just dripping down my arm. I'm like, oh, I'm never gonna fucking play again. Oh my god. And my friend Alex is sobbing, and he's going like 110 down the interstate as we go down to the hospital in Ames. And
that's pretty impressive in a sob.
His sob was the shit. The shit. I don't know. He had a really nice sob.
That's
was
the point of the story.
Right? Yeah. But like, yeah, like, so like it actually, it's still in there. Like they never went in through and took it out because it was so close. Like, well, if we go in, there's a chance we could nick your artery. So we're not going to go ahead and take it out. We're going to assume that like things are going to kind of crystallize or whatever will be over top of it. Like your scar tissue is just going to kind of engulf it. So it's still sitting in there. Like I've got a tiny little scar. Cause again, it was like a little bullet that just kind of went in and stuck in there. And every once in a while, like if I'm playing, or if I'm playing volleyball in particular, like it'll feel dead right there. So I don't know, like if just like the repetitive motion of that just feels there, but yeah. So essentially I had a self-inflicted gunshot wound from that. And I didn't play tennis for like 8 or 9 months, like 8 months, I want to say, because that was June of 1999. And I didn't play again until the middle of the spring, something like that. So
is that why you call your right arm the sledgehammer? Like you want a piece of the sledgehammer because there's a piece of sledgehammer in this.
No, but when I get drunk enough at our sand volleyball stuff and we're winning by enough, like in the second or third game, my friends will call for the hammer, which is me hitting a jump serve. And before I throw the ball up to hit the jump serve, I said, uh-oh, here come the hammer. And inevitably miss it every single time and never, ever make it in.
Maybe if you, instead of spending that pregnant pause not saying anything, you just set it and then hit it, you would actually get it on time. Because like, I just sort of imagine the ball landing as you're in the middle of, here comes the hammer.
Here comes the hammer.
No so, more yeah, dramatic there you go. Effect. Moral of the story is Tim is basically Tupac, Kevin taking a shot.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like when you're playing pool, right? And like if the game's going really well and you're trying to intimidate somebody, eventually you stare at them right in the face as you take one of your shots. Like you don't even look at the ball and you hit the ball and you always miss.
You scratch.
But one day I'll make it. Yeah. One day I'll make it. And when I do make it, when I'm staring at that person in the eye, he's going to be like, this is the biggest badass that's ever lived. And I'll just kind of nod slowly. I bet, but I could probably get a couple drinks out of the deal. I bet it's possible.
So that was probably one of our longest pretend you're getting to know us is ever. So let's go ahead, because I guess it's good because of this next subject we're getting into, which is fucking Radford.
Do you want and to talk about family cancers or anything like that?
That's way too happy for us at this point. Let's just go ahead and get it to fucking Radford. And also, the name of the team we are played is not just Radford. They are now fucking Radford. Because fucking what the hell happened? What happened? The team is ranked the highest in Shaka Smart's tenure as a head coach at Texas, after beating UNC and keeping it close against Michigan State, and they lose to fucking Radford. What? Why did this happen? Tell me, why did this happen?
Well, I think I won't speak for Tim. I will just speak for myself and say that I definitely took Radford too lightly. I think that I discounted their Notre Dame win.
So did Texas.
Yeah. Yeah, I discounted their Notre Dame win as sort of a Notre Dame's not Notre Dame this year. It's probably not a big deal. And I discounted the fact that Radford is probably going to win the Big South. So they're not nobody. This is not Kent State. This is not Chaminade, for that matter. But Texas should have won that game. Absolutely. Like, they 9 times out of 10, they're winning that game, or even 9.5 games out of 10, they're winning that game. But I don't know if the coaching staff ran them into the ground in the off week, or if they just weren't up for, you know, it didn't seem like they didn't care. They didn't seem like they had the necessary energy to combat a Radford team that was very up for the moment. And it sucks that they lost. It ruins what was a, you know, good building block coming out of the UNC Michigan State, you know, the whole Vegas trip. They got to regroup, because it's not the worst loss in Texas history, but it's not a good loss. And the best they can hope for is that Radford does well enough that it doesn't show up as a bad loss come March.
To me, this was a game that kind of highlights when Shaka's system offensively gets it wrong, it gets it way wrong. And I think this game was showcasing that in a way that was troubling, because if you listen to the Texas players and the coaching staff, if you have interactions with them, everybody knows, like, they're like, what we talk about here on the podcast is not some kind of like, oh my gosh, they're visionaries. Everyone knows Texas is at their best when they're getting dribble penetration. Everybody knows that when we can play in the lane, we're in better shape. And yet, over and over, we saw a Texas team against Radford that just would not attack the paint. You know, 7 of Kerwin's 12 shots were from deep. 7 of Dylan's 15 shots were from deep. 4 of Matt's 9 shots were from deep. And it was just like, come on, guys. If you know that we're at our best when we're attacking, why are we settling for some of these shots? And, you know, and admittedly, I think actually a lot of Dylan's looks from the outside were wide open, like uncontested three. So for him to go 1 for 7 from deep was not great. But from another standpoint, if we talk about what makes Shaka really special, it's this unwavering belief that he has in his players that we are going to get you there. He shows them tape every single day. Here's where we want you to attack. Here's where we feel comfortable with you being on the ball. Here is where we think that you can shine as an offensive player. And for a guy like Kerwin and a guy like Dylan and a guy like Matt, he would look at them and say, you're going to make the next one. You're going to make the next three. You're going to make this next shot. You're going to make the next play. And that's great, right? When that belief leads to them making a play. But it just didn't against Radford, because that belief was like, all right, I'm going to make the next hard bounce three-point shot I'm going to take, says Kerwin. Oops, I'm 1 for 7. Or I'm going to not shot fake, and I'm just going to chuck up another three, even though I'm not on fire from outside, says Dylan. Oops, I went 1 for 7. And it was one of those things where you're like, total confidence in your playing ability is great, guys, unless it's a game like we played against Radford. So I look at that, and, you know, on the one hand, it's hard to blame Shaka when his guys were missing wide open threes. We've talked about this ad nauseum over the entire, you know, all the years we've been together, but they're missing those threes. And it's, you know, how do you blame a coach for giving his players confidence? But at the other hand, you know, does that free reign lead to games where we shoot, what was it, 5 for 32 or something like that from deep as a team? Texas
had a stretch of time where they only hit one shot for like 6 minutes, and that happened twice in the game.
Which they have multiple times this season, but they've always
in last season.
Right, but they've always sort of eventually this year, like what has made this year a little bit better is they've figured it out eventually. Like they come back to the paint as dribble penetrators. Like they get back to it, they figure it out eventually. Like, okay, we do it just enough, but we just took contested hard bounce three-pointer after hard bounce three-pointer, and it just, we never got it together. And Radford made enough good shots, and we couldn't get out of our own way, and it was just a really difficult game to sit through and watch. It's
very frustrating. But what can you take away from this game? You know, why did they lose to this team from almost as nowhere as Lexington, Virginia? All you Washington and Lee people out there, where, you know, nobody's going to get that joke.
I love
where,
it. I love
where
it. A little bit
is...
D3 shade.
They beat my WashU Bears, and my brother goes there. But, you know, what can you take away from this game? What can you take away from this loss? How do you make sure that this never, ever happens again until you face UT Arlington again and it happens again?
Well, so, okay, you can never ensure it will never happen again because it's, you know, it's sports. I guess look at it as the other side of the coin from Vegas in that I think it's fair to say at this point, and this is not exactly a mind-blowing statement, that if Texas makes less than a third of their threes, they're vulnerable to lose to anybody because they have made it plain that they are going to shoot a pretty large amount of threes this year. They are sort of following the same trend that the NBA and to a somewhat lesser extent the NCAA is following, where they are more reliant on the three ball than they were 10 or 15 years ago. if Texas does not make one out of every three of their threes, they're vulnerable to a loss, in part because, you know, it becomes a less efficient shot, in part because it doesn't, you know, nobody has to guard them honestly, so they don't get dribble penetration opportunities. And, you know, they hit far less than one out of every three against Radford. And this is sort of the variance that basketball in general, again, more so in the NBA than the NCAA, but basketball in general is becoming more reliant on open or reasonably open three-point shots and making those than it has been at any point in the past, and it probably is only going to increase as time goes on. So it's when you look at the way they played against North Carolina and even the way they played against Michigan State for the first half, give or take, you saw what they can do when the shots that are open are hitting, and even when the shots that are slightly contested are hitting. On the other side, what you're seeing against like Radford is you see what happens when the shots, open shots are not hitting and the slightly contested shots are not hitting. This team gets bogged down offensively, and you know, and games against lesser opponents become much more problematic. I don't know that I am going to take this as a, you know, harbinger of the rest of the season, because frankly, Texas has a clunker against somebody every year. Last year it was Tennessee State. The year before it was Kent State. I mean, they've had ones before that, and so you know, until they show that they're going to have this sort of outlier again, and it no longer becomes an outlier, then I'm just going to say it sucked. Let's see how they react before coming to a larger conclusion.
So then how damning of a loss is this for Shaka Smart? This is his third year in a row where he has had one game where he cannot outplay and outcoach a team. His team is just so much better than on paper, in the weight room, on against other teams. This just every year, like you said, Kent State, UT Arlington, last year Tennessee Tech, this year's Radford. Every year he's had this issue, regardless of who he has out there. It seems like this might be a Shaka Smart problem. Is it? How damning is this loss for Shaka Smart?
This one is a little bit tougher for me because of the standpoint of a couple of things. The first is, this should be his best team. So, you know, UT Arlington a few years ago when Texas was bad, like, look, they were bad. But they shouldn't be bad this year. And I think that if you go back in the past years when Rick Barnes was successful, and he didn't have this a ton towards the end of his career at Texas or his time at Texas, but if you go back to the early years, even TJ's first year and for maybe an 8 or 10 game stretch in TJ's sophomore year, we didn't shoot the ball particularly well. And eventually Texas did shoot well in that 2002-03 season. But there was a stretch in the middle there, the early part of the conference season, where they weren't shooting really well at all. And TJ found a way to get into the lane anyways. Now, TJ was a transcendent player, clearly. But there was also kind of that understanding, like, he's not going to quit. Like, he's not going to stop getting into the lane. And that offense is not totally dissimilar from what we're seeing run right now. And I think that we are watching this as, I think it's pretty easy to look at this year's team and say, hey, this is Kerwin's team. You know, I thought it was going to be Matt's team, but right now it certainly seems to be his, you know, Kerwin's. He's the highest usage player. He is a senior. He has taken the most shots on the team, at least per game. And he should be personifying Shaka's program right now, right? He's had 4 years where he's been a focal point at some level on Shaka's teams, and yet we're still here saying, what is with this decision-making? What is going on here? And while you can point to a different game each different season that Shaka's been around, this one is tougher for me because I can't justify why Kerwin just had a game like this when Texas has so much on the line. And look, a loss against Radford, I don't think it's going to be the end of the world as far as not making the tournament. That's not the kind of loss it is. This is still a tournament team, just as it was last Friday at 5:30 p.m. But I had higher hopes for this. I had hopes that we were past this, that Kerwin was past this, that Dylan was going to be, you know, was not going to have a game like this when Texas needed him to be good. But here we are. So without being Chicken Little, I do find a lot of things to say, oh, maybe more than any other game under Shaka, that loss, while not being damning or uncontrollable as far as coming back from it, there were just so many things where, like, we should be better than this. We shouldn't have this type of, you know, offensive ineptitude when they know they have to do other things to be successful offensively. And yet it happened, it happened, it happened. And what are you going to do?
You got nothing, Johnny? You nothing on whether or not this is a damning loss for Shaka Smart?
I mean, I guess, again, like I said earlier, it depends on how they react. Like, if they go out and land in the red against VCU, I get more concerned than I was at the end of that game. Because, you know, with Texas being a fringe top 25 team, like, they were 17, they're now 30th if you go by the votes, which, you know, they're somewhere in that range of 17 to 30, depending on how you want to look at them. That's a good team that is also not, you know, it's not an inevitable team. They have their flaws. They have, they will have up and down games. So especially in light of a 31 plus game season, plus whatever postseason they have, you know, it's one data point that, I'm taking, but I want to see if it becomes more than one data point, if it becomes a trend.
And I would agree with that. And I think if they had played Radford and they had, you know, shot 32% from the lane, right? So if they had been attacking and they had gotten into the lane and just missed shots at the rim, that just had an uncharacteristic day where they had shot terribly from inside the arc, but still were playing intelligently, I would probably take a little bit less from that than I do from this. Because where I will come back to is, they just shot as a team. I'm sorry, I really should have looked that up before. Did anyone have the box score of that game in front of them?
They were 47% from two and 18.5% from three.
And how many threes did they shoot?
27.
Okay, so they were 5 for 27 from deep. And they, the players, have that kind of game in them. You know, like, it's one of those things where you don't wanna think that any team is who they are on their worst day. And I'm not really concerned with them shooting 18% from three. That's gonna happen. But it's one thing to shoot 18% from three when they may, you know, when they take 16 of them. But they were 18% from three when we knew we had to attack, and they still didn't. And so I think Johnny's right. If we are 2-0 this week and we beat VCU and Purdue, okay, the ship kind of is looking like it's headed in a direction that we're more comfortable with. But to watch a team struggle in that way and keep on playing that same style, it's tough to not be troubled by it, given the circumstances of this being year four and having a team that is still pretty healthy and whatnot.
You kind of answered my question. And I want to, actually, before we get into the next point, I want to point something out. There is one data point or one trending point that you can definitely look at, which, over the past however long Shaka Smart's been here, has been a factor for Texas, and that has just been shooting. They are just not a good shooting team. For a team that wants to play offense like Fred Hoiberg, where you're just jacking up threes all day long, they don't have that ability. They don't. And I think another thing you found out in this game is you can't rely on your front court for their offense. I mean, yeah, Sims was the only guy scoring points, and Jackson Hayes as well, but you can't rely on those guys. You have to rely on your guards for this team because that's where your strength is, and they're not making shots. They can't make the open shots.
Well, they can. They don't always. And this is sort of, I mean, look, this is college basketball. There's a reason why this isn't the NBA, because you don't have teams full of 40% three-point shooters. Like, you're going to get wide variance. It's outside of the, you know, last year's Villanova team, for example, or, you know, TCU last year. Outside of those teams, you're going to get a lot of variance. And it sucks, and I don't enjoy watching them go, you know, 18% from three. But at the same time, there's a reason why these guys are not in the pros right now.
Still, man, still, there's teams that have less talent than Texas, but more consistency.
Sure.
And that's what you need at Texas. You need consistency with the talent you have. And that Shaka Smart has not provided that over the past 3 years.
No, and that is a fair criticism. I'm not butting up against that. I think if you took this entire squad and made them all 2 years older and they still perform like this, then it would be an even more valid criticism. I feel like at this while Texas is older than they have been, and they are not as desperately young as they were the last couple of years, they're still in the bottom third of D1 because they're still relying on guys like Coleman, who's a sophomore. Jace is a sophomore, isn't he?
Ramey's
a freshman. Sims is a sophomore. Hayes is a freshman. Like really outside of Osakowski and Roach, who, you know, obviously play enormous roles on this team, they're all still underclassmen. You know, and you've got Eli Long, who, God love him, shoots 48 shots a game if you let him, and he might make 12 of them. But he's, you know, like, and he provides a lot of other things, but he's dragging down the average something fierce on his own. So I don't disagree with your premise, and I wish they were shooting better from three. But we are in a Barnesian situation of Shaka likes athletes. He likes superb athletes, and he's got a number of them on here. But the problem with getting guys who are superb athletes is that they don't tend to be superb shooters. And maybe by the time they get to their third or fourth year, they become, you know, above average shooters. And
if they stick around for that long.
If they stick around that long. And this is sort of the Sophie's choice of NCAA basketball these days, is if you get a guy like Jackson Hayes, who is this sort of all-world athlete, and as enticing as it is to watch him play, you don't want him shooting outside of 8 feet for obvious reasons. But at the same time, he's probably not going to be here 3+ years from now where you see him, you know, show off like Sagaba Kanate right now is shooting 30-something percent from three because he's been at West Virginia for 3 years and he's worked on it and he's now doing it in games. But a guy like Jackson Hayes is probably going to be gone before that. So it's kind of, it's great that they're recruiting like this, but there are downsides to it.
So in terms of the season, how bad is this loss and what do you need to do to basically hide it?
I mean, you can't hide it in these days with net and, you know, KenPom and all, you know, all that sort of stuff. There's no hiding a loss. Like it's there. It's uncoverable. But it's partly on Texas on how they're going to react to it and whether they're going to let that loss turn into a VCU loss and or a Purdue loss. It's partly on Radford to see how good they actually are this season, because if they end up, you know, winning the Big South, then it doesn't look as bad on paper in March. It won't be a Kent State situation. It definitely won't be a Chaminade situation. You know, Texas needs to rebound. They need to get their shit together. They need to remember that they cannot go 70% and win games just because they're Texas. They need to go all out. And it's incumbent upon the coaching staff to put them in a situation where they can go all out on a regular basis.
Then let's get into this next week's worth of games, which is VCU and Purdue, as you said. How big is this week's worth of games coming up after the loss to fucking Radford?
Well, if they lose either of the games, you start thinking about it from a standpoint of this is going to be probably a bubble team, you know, without putting too much emphasis on just a couple of games. All of a sudden, if they split, they're 6-3 with a decent chance of winning the last couple of games in the non-conference season, but that puts them, I think, at 9-3 before we get into the Big 12. You know, if they're 9-3, a couple of things are probably true. They're probably going to be no better, just because that might be the time. Like that might just actually be a good indicator of what kind of team they are. If they're 9-3, then you're probably looking at maybe best case scenario a 10-8 season in the Big 12, and then you're looking at a 11 plus loss team. I don't know. So I think that. This is a they're at a tough spot, as Johnny says, because a win against VCU could kind of maybe get them emotionally back on the right track if they can win on Wednesday and then have the, you know, have a decent chance on Sunday against a Purdue team that is capable but also has their own flaws. Then they can, you know, we need to have, it really would be important for us to have no more than two non-conference losses. If we can get out of the non-conference slate, including the Georgia Big 12 SEC Challenge game, if we can get out of the non-conference slate 11-2, you have some buffer there in the Big 12 of being average to a little bit above average in the league and still getting yourself a decent NCAA tournament seed. I do think if this team comes out of the end of the regular season and is not fighting for a you know, at least a 6 or a 5 seed in the tournament, that's probably going to be a downside. And as much as you don't want to overload what these two games are going to mean for that, if we split, then that's going to be a tough out. Like, we're going to have a difficult time getting to that. So Texas has to bring their A game. They have to be ready to play. And I think they will be, because I think they probably know how damning that loss against Radford could end up being to their tournament hopes, or at least to their seeding hopes. But it's hard to overstate, in my opinion, hard to overstate just how much a loss could mean here. Like, win both of these games and, you know, all right, maybe we're back on the right track. Maybe lose one of these games and we're like, all right, well, we truly are not the team that we thought that we were.
Yeah, and I think it depends on... So if we're talking about a scenario in which Texas loses one of these games, it really depends on which game they lose. Like, losing to Purdue, who is has a very similar sort of RPI KenPom look about them as Texas does, is not really a damning situation. I mean, Carson Edwards is a baller. Purdue has Purdue has a lot of has aspirations of their own. So losing to them is not as big a deal as losing to VCU would be. In fact, I would say that if Texas loses to VCU, they're more likely to lose to Purdue than not. But I still don't think that's who this Texas team is yet. I guess for me, when it looks like Texas was never going to be a Final Four team this year. Like, that's just not who they were at this point. They look like they are an improved team upon last year. They look like they could, you know, make a little noise in the NCAA tournament. But I was never thinking, oh, you know, they can get to the Final Four, you know, with the right draw. Like, even with the right draw, I still don't see them making a huge run. So for me, it was about sort of larger program trajectory. So if you look at something like the VCU game, I feel like they better win that game, if for no other reason than, you know, VCU hasn't won a road game all year this year. It's not the VCU of Shaka's tenure, even. If they can beat VCU at VCU, they should be able to beat VCU in Austin, and I think they should take care of that, even if there's, you know, 1,200 people in the stands or however many show up for that game. The Purdue game, I think, is another good sort of barometer or, you know, heat check for the season, as it were, because it's not last year's Purdue team, but it is a talented Purdue team, and I really think they've got some, you know, they have something, they have March aspirations as well. So I hope they win both of these. If they do, then I think people will, you know, as much as they do, stand down about Shaka.
Yeah, as you say, the VCU game should be, if they can't get up for VCU, if they can't kind of bring their, you know, their best game for that game, that would be that would be a tough pill for everyone to swallow. I'm sure, not least of us, Shaka Smart. The Purdue game, as you say, will be an interesting one. When I've watched them play, they're pretty perimeter-centric. They have Edwards, as you say. They've got a couple other guys who shoot pretty well from outside. They're not crazy athletic. They're not crazy lengthy. But certainly they've got some guys who are heady with the ball and as we said, are pretty comfortable shooting from outside. What I think it could be, if you're looking for any silver lining, is Texas has up to the Radford game, played with fire in every single game, I suppose, except for the North Carolina game, where if the staff is saying, attack, we have to attack. Hey, guys, we need to attack. We need to figure this out. The players maybe would have had some type of like, yeah, well, we keep on winning. Even if they didn't play the best and didn't win by the margin that we had hoped that they would win by, they've still been able to rely on that. Well, now we can't say that anymore. Like, you've lost a game that you should have won.
Right.
And so if that's the wake-up call that this Texas team needs, like, all right, we really truly can't compete even against a above but like on the top end of the middle of the pack team like Radford in the country, what are we going to do against even a Baylor or an Oklahoma State who is probably better than Radford too? And so if they can take that loss and parlay that into, okay, we must play this way. If we don't play this way, we are super beatable, as opposed to, well, we had rough stretches against Arkansas, we pulled it out. We had rough stretches against ULM, we pulled it out. Well, against Radford, they didn't. So if this can galvanize the offense to a point where they say, yes, everybody that can attack is ready to go, this genuinely is the kind of style that we're going to have to play, then fantastic. But it'll be a tough go. Purdue can play. And Edwards, I would not be shocked if he's ready to rock, as a kid that did not get recruited by Texas, who instead recruited whom? Who did the Texas choose over Edwards? Anyone know? Anyone? Anyone?
I'm going to assume Jacob Young.
That's the guy. So, wouldn't be surprising to see Edwards come into that game with a chip on his shoulder. So, we will have to be ready for that.
Yeah, and I don't think Texas is going to be galvanized. I think this offense is going to struggle throughout the season. But anyways, let's go to the VCU, and let's talk about who they are. Let's preview the VCU game. Who is VCU? And what do they do that is special?
I mean, as it is usually with VCU, it is a former Shaka assistant who is coaching, much like Radford, a former Shaka assistant who is coaching there. However, with VCU, they are still trying to do the press. They're still trying to attack with their defense. They don't do a lot super well, if I'm honest. Like, they're about a Radford. Although, like, what they hang their hat on defense. They don't shoot the ball well, much at all, and they don't give the ball away they force a lot of turnovers, I should say. So, you know, they haven't won an away game all year. This would be their first away win if they did. I mean, they won a neutral site against Temple, but that's still not the same. So, you know, I at the risk of minimizing yet another opponent, Texas should win this game if they play their game and they play at the intensity level they should.
And I don't like Johnny says, you don't want to poo-poo a second mid-major team in a row. But I think Radford is a better three-point shooting team than VCU was, and even Radford shot pretty poorly against us. They just made one more shot is all. And VCU doesn't quite have the same level of athletes that they had, that they've had kind of previously, both under Anthony Grant or under Shaka. So be difficult to see them hanging from that standpoint. I will be interested to see how much they pack it in. You know, the jury is obviously pretty much in, Will, as you've been saying, that we're going to struggle because how many teams are going to pressure us out to 24, 25, 27 feet like UNC did for a while. Probably pretty rare moving forward. So this is simply what it's going to be. We're going to see zone. We're, you know, even against active teams, we're going to see sagging man, even against teams that want to kind of play those passing angles. So how we generate some looks against them. I was surprised at how poorly we took care of the ball against Radford. That was one of our poorer games of the year as far as limiting our own turnovers. So that didn't help matters.
Yeah, I think that was the worst turnover margin that we had on the season.
And that's taking into effect some of the terrible games that I think Jericho and Dylan had earlier in the season when they both combined for like 10 turnovers in two straight games or whatever it was. But so VCU is going to want to get out and you know, both make us execute against a team that is, you know, will pack it in a little bit, but also shoot some angles when they can and try to get some deflections just like we want to do. So we should be way better than them, and I think we are way better than them, but it'll be interesting to see if we come with our emotional standpoint of like we're going to play for 40 minutes and be ready to rock, or if there's some hangover from that Friday game, because I think that it was telling to see the end of that game against Radford how just kind of dumbfounded a lot of the players looked. Like, what is this? How did we just lose this game? So hopefully they can shake that off and be ready to go, because if not, VCU is not a pushover by any stretch.
And the two guys to watch on VCU are going to be Marcus Evans and Isaac Van. Marcus Evans, number two, junior guard. Guys averaging about 14 points per game, kind of the guy who runs their entire offense. And then Isaac Van's the guy who receives most of their offense, the forward, number 23, another junior. Those two guys are basically VCU's entire offense and team. So that's what I would be watching for, is those two guys, and that's what Texas is basically going to be focusing on, is those two guys and stopping them. So that's basically VCU for y'all. So then let's go ahead and get into Purdue. God, that's tongue twister. Let's go ahead and get into Purdue. Who are they, Johnny?
Just hammer those consequences. Hammer those consonants. There you go.
Wow, we are on fire.
Into Purdue.
Who are they and what do they do special, Johnny?
Carson Edwards is obviously the headliner. He is, I've said this, I don't even know how many times at this point, a National Player of the Year candidate. And he is a very high usage player. They shoot the three a lot more than Texas, actually. But the difference being they shoot it well. Carson Edwards has taken 76 three-pointers this year, which is almost as much as I think it was Roach and Coleman combined. Yeah, because Roach has taken 46 and Coleman's taken 34. So that's a little more than 76, but not much. And then they've got another guy who's shot 68. And that guy, Ryan Klein, is shooting almost 46% on the year. So, yeah, maybe keep an eye on him. He's a wing. He's going to shoot a lot of threes. So it's going to be incumbent upon guys like Roach and, to a lesser extent, Hepa and Osakowski to try and keep up with that guy on the perimeter.
What type of defense do you use to do that, Johnny and Tim? If you're Shaka Smart, how would you try to game plan against that?
Well, we're going to have a pretty sizable athletic advantage against them. Edwards is not the tallest guy. Klein is a good shooter, and he's got some good length. He's not a tremendous athlete. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how we can kind of contest with chasing around screens. I think when we saw Texas play against Michigan State, there were some issues that Michigan State was able to kind of, especially on their ball screens or some of their down screens away from the ball, they manhandled this a little bit, so they're able to kind of create some spacing. I'm not certain if Purdue will have that same ability. They're not quite as solid up top as Michigan State was. But Texas is going to have to be ready to fight through some screens, particularly because, as we said, like, Edwards is always a threat with the ball in his hands, and Klein is always a threat as a guy that can kind of be that release valve. And they have one other guy. I don't remember who's their third guy, Johnny, that can really shoot. They have another guy who's above 40%, I want to say.
There's Sasha Stefanovic, who is 10 of 22.
Okay. Anyways, so the big game that I watched with them was when they lost that game a little bit earlier in the season against Virginia Tech. And again, they shot the ball pretty well in that. Virginia Tech is built not dissimilarly from us in that we play with a lot of length and quickness and athleticism on defense. Texas is going to have to do that. We have to. We're going to want to make Edwards take some tough shots. We're going to want to limit how many times he can create shots for Klein as far as getting his open looks after lane touches. And we're going to have to play solid defense against screens away from the ball. If Texas can do that, which there's every reason to think that they can, we'll be in good shape. Like a lot of times this season where you've seen the hot and cold of our defense will be deflections. So how often we're able to get our hands on the ball and kind of get them out of their set offense where we're making them make plays, maybe off schedule or inside of, they were looking for one look and we forced them to make a play, you know, in one-on-one situations, we'll be in better shape. Because if it does come down to one-on-one, we have better, longer, quicker athletes. If we allow them to stay in their system, it could be trouble because they have the shooters to really hurt us if we get them some open looks or if we surrender some open looks when they're finding that out of their regular action.
I'm fine with one-on-one as long as it is not Carson Edwards in that one-on-one.
Well, it's gonna be a lot.
Yeah, no, I know. He's a sort of ball dominant, and he's more of a combo guard than a pure point guard, which, yeah. You know, has its pros and cons. I'm
tough
gonna be,
to be a pure point guard when you take 40% of your team's shots, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. A Russell Westbrook point guard. Yeah, it's they also, and we haven't even mentioned Matt Harms, who is 7'3", is the next in Purdue's long line of weirdly tall centers. He's going to be, it's another one of those guys that it was Gafford for Arkansas, who was really interesting to watch against Sims and Hayes for a different reason. Harms is going to be interesting to watch against Sims and Hayes to see, you know, if, you know, he really knows how to rebound the ball. It will be interesting to see if Sims and or Hayes and or Osakowski is able to get a decent amount of rebounds against a guy like that, because he's not going far from the basket. You know, he's taken 7 threes on the year, and those are probably all in blowouts where it didn't matter. So it's going to be interesting to see if Texas can create the additional shot opportunities they need off of the rebounds as opposed to trying to grab a bunch of steals. I mean, if they can do both,
find these guys. He's from the Amsterdam. He's from the Netherlands. Like, who are they looking for?
Well, everybody's 7'3" in the Netherlands. Honestly, it's a land of very tall blonde men. It's no wonder Hitler loved that place.
There's Will's hot take. There you go.
There you go. I don't know where they find him either. Purdue seems to be very adept at finding very tall white dudes who are not super athletic to begin with. Like, that's a guy who seems like he's definitely a 4-year player as opposed to Hayes, because he's not launching much in the way of threes. The NBA is probably not going to pay too much attention to him because it's not 1985 anymore.
Well, and if I could choose any type of, and obviously 7'3" is no joke, but if you could choose any type of center that you would be a little bit more comfortable with Jericho and Jackson playing against, it's a guy who has terrific length but not great athleticism. So I don't think, hopefully, Jericho won't get called for a bunch of over-the-backs against that guy. If he does, then fuck those refs. But our bigs against their bigs should be a pretty big athletic for sure advantage, and I think actually a skill advantage, even though Harms certainly can shoot a little bit and moves well, but I don't think he's seen two guys that can have the explosiveness that we've got. Even against Virginia Tech, where Virginia Tech was quite athletic, but hopefully we saw a game from Sims and Hayes where for sure that was Sims's best game. Yes, Johnny. I mean, offensively, no question about it. Yeah. So if that's representative of him saying, okay, I'm finally getting this figured out, then I still think we can really be, if not dominant offensively against them, certainly have a plus game from our big guys down low.
Yeah, I guess the question will be in that game whether the athleticism advantage of Sims and Hayes will outweigh Harms getting down low and getting position on those guys, because both of them have shown in different moments this year that they can rack up fouls pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So does Purdue manage to get him in a position where he puts those guys in foul trouble pretty easily, or does Texas take more advantage of getting Harms switched onto, you know, wings and guards so that they can take advantage of their athleticism advantage? That's going to be one of the key points there to me.
And if there's hope for that, it's that Texas, I don't think Hayes and Sims have picked up as many cheap fouls in one-on-one defense. We've seen a lot of fouls on rebounds. We've seen some fouls away from the ball. We haven't seen a ton of fouls, particularly from Sims, in those one-on-one situations. Hayes has been a little bit more susceptible to that, but I think there's still hope that will be a plus for us.
Yeah, Hayes is more the, he gets them on reach fouls, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Man, Hayes' fouls are just, are just, why? Just a bunch of whys. Just like, you're like, why, dude? Why are you doing that?
I can tell you
and
why.
And even he's like, damn, why the hell did I do that? Like,
yeah, I can tell you why. Because he has been the longest, most athletic dude at the previous level, and he's used to being able to just tap that ball. And now there's a dude in his way, and the NCAA will call that when high school does not call it as reliably. So he's having to adjust to how the NCAA game is getting refereed, and he's having to adjust to dudes who are just frankly stronger than him and can keep him out of position.
Right. But to Jackson's credit, he's done a tremendous job of not letting some of that foul trouble impede his aggressiveness.
Sure.
Like, he still plays hard.
Yeah.
That's been, if you can look for one thing to truly criticize Jericho about, like, I'm not super shocked that he's not a polished, finished product at this point, but he has allowed his foul trouble to get in his head and affect his production. And Jackson, even through foul trouble, even through some of those issues, keeps on attacking, keeps on playing really hard, going to the rim.
Well, I think on that note, y'all, we're going to end off there. Thank y'all for pretending we were football for the past hour. I've been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. Johnny Brashear, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at BetterWhiteGuy. And based on the amount of follows I've gotten off this, don't bother looking for me on Instagram because nobody's following me there. You can also find me on Barking Carnival. And I'm on Inside Texas as Tim Beam. So you can see me there.
All right. And where can we find Tim Preston, Johnny? Where in the wide, wide world is Tim Preston?
Where can we find Tim? So technically, Tim is... Tim's on Skype right now, which is pretty impressive because I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Wi-Fi in Algeria is not great. It's improving, but it's not great. Tim is currently there on a church mission. He has found an uncontacted tribe somewhere deep in the forest. And he heard that they really need some Jesus, and he's heading there.
The fact that we have Tim here is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah,
honestly. I'm heading to a small island off the coast of India next week. I hear good things.
And Tim, where can we find you on the internet, though, since you have some in Algeria?
InsideTexas.com and on Twitter, InsideTexasHoop, no S. So a lot of fun things going on at Inside Texas. Come on and join us.
And you guys can find us and our other shows on the Hornscast channel. It's the Hornscast Show on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, Spotify, Twitter, Facebook, Overcast, Stitcher, wherever you guys can find a podcast, you'll find the Hornscast. On that note, thank y'all for hanging out with us, and we will see y'all next week. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em.